Emily, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciated the invite.
We're just chatting off air. I asked you what you wanted to be called. You said you absolutely 100% have to call me doctor and nothing but doctor. And that is it. That is all you... No, I'm just kidding. But you know, a very simple question I want to start with. I used to do longer intros for my guests, and then I got lazy, and so I just started to make them do it. And so my first question is, who are you?
Yeah. Okay. My name is Emily Dow. I did not suggest that people call me doctor. That does get confusing with like the medical doctor thing. So I really just prefer not to, unless I'm in the university setting. That's a little bit different. But yeah, I have a doctorate. I have a PhD in exercise and nutritional sciences. That's kind of, I guess, my biggest credential at this point. I'm also a registered dietitian. I have my CSCS. It's a little bit of a combined background, I would say, in sort of the exercise science coaching space and then the nutrition space.
Can I follow up? I don't have a PhD in that stuff. You and I talk a lot about the same things in some ways, in the same topics, let's say. I'm curious, and I don't mean this as a self-deprecating comment, but I'll say it this way and then we'll take it in the more productive way. It's like, what do you feel your PhD and just pursuing higher levels of academia gives you that you feel really grateful for? You know, I think I will phrase it as like, what do you think that gives you over someone like me who doesn't have it? That's not what I mean. I mean, along the pursuit of higher and higher education, when you and I are going to talk about today, a little bit of this discussion of how deep do we go on some of the things with clients? And so you have a lot of that deeper knowledge. What are you most grateful for in terms of just what you've gained from pursuing a PhD in something where some people might say something to the effect of like, hey, health and training and exercise, not that complicated. Like, what do you need a PhD for? Yeah. Something. I know if that person says it that way, they're just get slapped. But yeah, I'm curious what you're most grateful for in pursuing a higher level of education in something like exercise and nutrition.
Yeah, no, I actually really love that question because I think that my responses may be unexpected. I definitely don't think you need to have that level of higher education to be very proficient as a communicator in this space or to educate others in this space. It's 100% not necessary. And honestly, I think that my greatest takeaways from my experience in higher education had nothing to do with the like information itself. And that's what I went into it looking for. And I think a lot of people can probably relate to this, where you're kind of seeking a higher level of certainty in the way that you're able to speak to people and just in your own personal understanding of these concepts. And I think that's what I was hoping for. And I kind of got bitch slapped, for lack of a better term, when I actually was in that landscape and realized that it really wasn't about the content. It's more so about sort of learning an approach to the content, but then also, I mean, mine was a research focused program. I did like human clinical trials as my dissertation work. So it was very much focused on educating me on how to be an effective researcher, how to interpret research, how to communicate that research. And I think my most valuable takeaways more so had to do with that process. And if anything, gaining greater respect for the people who engage in that process, and just how messy all of it can honestly be, which I don't think is something that you would understand just as a layperson in the public, which has pros and cons associated with it, honestly.
It makes you definitively worse at social media because you know how, you will speak with just enough uncertainty that it will prevent you from going as viral. I mean, you're tremendous at social media. Yeah. You do wonderful. You put out amazing content, but more in a joking manner. I mean, the more you know, the less you'd feel comfortable speaking in hyperbolic terms and absolutes. And so you're like, now I know too much. I have all these damn caveats, you know?
No, 100%. I mean, like all of my videos, I have to cut myself at the 3-minute mark because I will just add all the disclaimers and all the nuance. And that's actually been like one of my biggest hurdles in learning how to effectively communicate in online spaces, is making myself be a little bit more succinct, walking that very fine line between communicating in a way that will actually land with the most people, but also doesn't lack the nuance that I think is necessary to also be honest and transparent.
From the outside looking in, and you can correct me or just, you know, shift it based on how you feel. I feel like your followers appreciate the way you communicate things in slightly more thorough manner. You know, we're all threading a needle of who we're trying to speak to, and that will require more or less detail with the way we describe things and certain terminology. And I find that you, I'll say it this way, but again, I don't mean it in any negative way. Like, I'm surprised at how much your, like I say, I'm surprised how much your audience really does appreciate how thorough you are. I appreciate it. I mean, it's just like, I know that not everybody is using social media in the same way. I see a 2 minute video, 2.5 minute video. I see somebody who's elaborating on a mechanism or explaining something, and I get quite excited about it. But I know that I'm not the average Instagram user. I look at your content and I'm like, I'm happy, very proud and happy to see 2 minute videos, 2.5 minute videos where people are engaging and watching. And clearly you look at the views and comments and people are really appreciating it. So I think that's super cool from the outside looking in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it surprises me too, to be quite honest, because I 100% thought, and I've kind of played the game. I've tried to speak to the algorithm. I've tried to do like the trending audio and the B-roll stuff. And it's, thank God that has never worked for me, because it's really not me and it's not super authentic to how I communicate. So I think that's honestly part of why it tends to land well with people, is because I'm just genuinely speaking the way that I do in my life and with students and whatnot. But yeah, it's kind of bizarre that traditionally all the things that you're told will never work have kind of worked. And I do think part of that is also just like people maybe getting sick of the other types of content that have gone viral for so long, and specifically like a certain niche expecting and wanting more at a certain point, which is what I'm really happy if that's sort of starting to catch a little bit of wind, because that's what people like you and I really enjoy.
Totally. The optimistic outlook of social media and science communication on the internet, or just any communication on the internet, is that you should be you, and in doing so will attract people who vibe with who you are and want to buy from someone like you and interact with somebody like you. And that's like the optimistic view of social media. It's just like sometimes like just be you. Isn't just enough. But I think that that's where people should lead with. If you're going to try, you know, first of all, it's exhausting to be somebody else. And second of all, you know, you want to create buy-in with the authentic you in your page. And so I think you're doing that. You're like, hey man, I'm going to be me and I'm going to attract people who like what I do. And that's how I want to interact with social media and the internet.
Yeah, 100%. And that doesn't mean that you just get to like do what you want and expect it to work either. It's like a process of being yourself, but being willing to sort of iterate how you approach that based on feedback, based on how people are responding and all of that as well.
Yeah, I used to be really resistant to the headspace of what will my followers want. I used to be really resistant to that. I was like, I'm just going to do what I want all the time. And I think that there's just a happy medium of like, hey, you can ask yourself the question of like, what do people care about? And what do I care about? And how is this going to land? And how would I like to say it? And try and find a happy medium there. So again, I think you're doing that wonderfully.
Totally. Well, I appreciate that. Cause yeah, that's a balance I've been trying to strike this whole time.
Aren't we all? Totally. Let's talk about, we'll do a couple of these podcast warm-up questions, you know, just kind of loosen off, shake off the rust, you know. What's something you've changed your mind about over the last 5 to 10 years?
A lot of things. So it's a little bit hard to choose, but I would say the whole entire reason I actually started a PhD in the first place was because I was fascinated by the gut microbiome and the gut brain axis. And I think all of us were sort of like enamored by that concept when it first came on the map, at least. And that's what I chose to talk about for my master's thesis. Realized it was, you know, kind of a wide open landscape still to learn much more about in a research context. So that's what I focused on largely throughout my PhD. And man, I wasn't originally fascinated by the concept of like probiotic supplementation and all of that surface level stuff that gets talked about all the time. And the more that I learned specifically about that topic, I've pulled back entirely almost on like my actual recommendations that I apply to myself, that I apply to others, that I recommend, you know, on social media and whatnot, because it's still so understudied and understood, like poorly understood, that's an area that I've like, yes, there's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of excitement, but I've pulled back tremendously on my level of confidence in how we actually make recommendations based on that field.
Can you give me a couple specifics?
Yeah, so I think like there's a lot of really promising research on things like probiotic supplementation, for example. But the more that we begin to learn about the microbiome, we kind of understand that it's so individual and it is more like a fingerprint where everybody's ecosystem is so distinct from one another that making sweeping recommendations for, hey, let's introduce these specific strains for everyone is a little bit of an oversimplification and in some cases could cause problems because you don't necessarily know enough about the characteristics of the ecosystem that you're introducing those strains into, for example. So it's possible that like if we make sweeping recommendations about like take this specific probiotic, that could benefit some people and really hurt others potentially. So that's like a very surface level example that comes to mind. But yeah, the gut in general is honestly just a lot more complex than I even realized going into it, despite it seeming kind of complex at the outset too.
Like I said, terrible at social media because you could have easily made some sweeping claims like most people do about the gut. You know what's like what I've and I feel very similarly. I didn't go down the rabbit hole as far as you did, but similarly in my own pursuit of down this gut health rabbit hole, it's like what do we like absolutely know? We absolutely know that like t taking on a on population average level, like taking care and slash gut health's important for stuff, you know, like for a lot of things and stuff. And the basic boring stuff tends to fall pretty much, or the things that really do help, the big ROI, big rock stuff tends to fall in line with like the other basic boring health related habits that you should probably do. And on a very individual level, if you have certain gut health issues or clinical issues, or like you said, on an individual level, things like probiotics, et cetera, how much fiber you can have, what kinds of fiber, FODMAPs, whatever. Maybe there's some more interesting chat, but on a population level, it's like, you know, it's not so simple as like, oh, everyone needs a probiotic, or everyone shouldn't take a probiotic, or everyone should take this probiotic. So, yeah, it's slightly more complicated, but in some ways, the average person can just let that go, in my opinion, the complication of it, and say, I probably need to, you know, XYZ, not drink too much alcohol, like, you know, exercise, eat enough fiber, diverse plant diet, all these things that we kind of know are good and support, you know, quality gut health on average.
100%. Yeah. And it would be so easy. And this is like the frustrating piece about just dealing with social media. It would be so easy for someone in our position to recommend probiotic. Like, I have enough credentials behind me. I have enough research on the gut behind me that if I recommended a probiotic, people would buy it and I could make a lot of money. And even when it comes to like my dissertation research, which it's a little, I won't get all into the weeds with it because it gets a little bit convoluted, but we were essentially looking at an exogenous way of supplementing acetic acid, which is a short chain fatty acid, beneficial byproducts of the way that our gut metabolizes fermentable fibers. We were having people take vinegar, which is an exogenous source of acetate, to see if introducing that as opposed to having to produce it ourselves would have similar outcomes. And our research is so early. There were like some promising findings. None of this is published yet, so I can't get super into the detail of it, but it like the first thought of a lot of people in the room when I was defending my dissertation was like, oh, you need to sell something like this instead of being able to like extrapolate the fact that this is a very small study, very small sample size, like very limited pool of research where I was citing mostly rodent models. But that's the road that that goes down when it starts catching any sort of finding, starts catching like wildfire in the public. So that's the kind of thing that just people need to be cautious of as consumers, is how quickly those recommendations can land, even way before they should.
Yeah, the idea that we could, you know, just for the listener, like super basics, and please spit this back out in a more understandable way, but like you eat fiber, your gut bacteria, you know, it's fermented by your gut bacteria and they produce what are called short chain fatty acids, and those things do good stuff for you. And you're saying that so part of your research was, could I just take those short chain fatty acids exogenously? Could I just take them instead of having to have my gut ferment the fiber, or my bacteria ferment the fiber and produce them? Could I just take them, and would that have a beneficial effect? That's somewhat what your research was on.
Correct. Yeah. And there's a lot of interest in that right now. There's a lot of work being done specifically because there's a few of these short chain fatty acids. Butyrate is one that's of high interest. And so I think a lot of people are trying to supplement butyrate exogenously. Of course, like that's of course what we all jump to is like, is there a shortcut? Is there a way that we can sort of bypass this process that we know is beneficial? My hesitation with that is that there's probably aspects of that process that we don't understand how they benefit us yet, but maybe are more necessary than just that like absolute outcome of the short chain fatty acid production. But yes, we were looking at vinegar because it contains acetate. Acetate quickly is converted into acetic acid in the bloodstream, and it can sort of mimic that production endogenously. But we were looking at how it actually related to people's training adaptations, which was interesting because that's not really something that has been super well explored at this point. But all of my hypotheses were sort of related to the interactions between exercise and the gut-brain axis and how all that sort of communicates with one another.
This would be considered like postbiotics.
Yes, it would exactly.
Okay.
And that's like when we talk about like fermented foods and the potential benefits there, that's part of what comes into that conversation is, if we're consuming things like vinegar, we know that they tend to be good for us. Is this one of the potential reasons? Because it introduces some of these exogenous
Gotcha. S
sources.
super cool. And you know, this is a fascinating topic. If you ever feel like there's something that comes of this research that's worth sharing, I hope you do.
Yeah, I will eventually this will get published and I can kind of share like the hypotheses, but essentially we saw some interesting things that we didn't expect. And based on other metabolomic, more complex analyses than we were able to perform, we can sort of hypothesize the mechanisms that were at play there. And I would be happy to dive into that eventually once I actually get this out there into the world.
Cool. Let's pivot. Let's talk about you for a second. I think people think of people in your position, my position, our chairs, so to speak, and that we do everything right, and that we have everything figured out, and we have the perfect relationship with our food and our bodies and our fitness and all this stuff. And we don't ever do something that would fall into the category of like not a perfect health and fitness influencer. So I want to ask you, what's one thing you do that you think you do well, that you're proud of, that you think you has a big impact on your relationship with food and fitness in your body, and you're like, hey, I do this really well and I know that it benefits me. And then on the flip side, something that maybe you do or don't do that you think you should do and are still working on.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think it's so important to like normalize these traits among fitness professionals because we're messy too. I think the thing that I'm very skilled at, and I think graduate school has forced me to become skilled at this, is adaptability and being flexible and not being super married to like my training schedule, for example, looking one specific way, because I see like clients and people in the world run into this so often where, okay, I have to modify this workout because I only have 30 minutes to get it done. And then it's this big drama. And I get it, like, because I also like adhering to a plan that I've laid out for myself. But I've had to learn to be very good about, okay, well, this week I'm going to get two training sessions in, and that's still better than nothing. Or I'm going to have to modify this workout based on my time constraints. That's still productive. I find that to be a feature of everyone who's consistent over the long term is that they're adaptable enough to recognize that.
Can you give me an example of when and how you might modify one of your sessions? Like, what's a strategy you might use in one of these moments where you need to make a modification?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, to some extent, this will kind of depend on like your overall training preferences and priorities, but typically it's very easy for me to kind of go in one of two directions. I can either trim off a lot of the accessory stuff towards the end of my lift because like most of us will know that the way that a lift is structured is sort of in order of priority. Like you've got the more taxing, the compound lifts, the high return on investment stuff at the beginning, and then as you become more fatigued is when you kind of introduce more of the accessory work. So one strategy is just, okay, I'm going to focus on more of the compound stuff today, and I'm just going to do my like clean and jerks and my squats. Call it good. I've done that many times. Alternatively, if I wanted to get all of those stimuli in for whatever set of reasons, I might just trim down the total volume and kind of do the whole two hard sets rule of thumb where, I give myself two challenging sets of everything, but I trim off like the third or the fourth set that maybe I had programmed. Those are probably the two that I use most commonly because that can easily turn like an hour, 60 to 90 minute session to like 30, 45 minutes for me.
Yeah, you're doing less exercises or you're doing less sets, right? You know, those are two good go-tos. Yeah, I love that. What are your current goals right now? What's your training like? I don't know too much about. I see that you do a bit of running. I see that you do some lifting, but I'm curious. Do you train for something in particular? What's a week of training look like?
Yeah, no, I'm not really training for anything specific right now, and that's where I'm enjoying living at the moment, which I know is not super common, I think, for people in our shoes. But I do a combination of a lot of, I had, during my PhD, I had a stint where I was really focused on the Olympic lifts, and I competed in a couple weightlifting meets.
That's when that I found you, obsession. I think. When I think I found you, you were doing a lot of Olympic lifting, and I thought that maybe that was your thing, or it was just your thing at the time, you know?
It was my thing at the time. I think it's kind of like a natural trajectory where I wanted to learn like the very technical skill piece, obsess over that for a little while. Worked with an awesome like Olympian Korean coach. He was incredible. So I was focused on that for a while, and I've continued to do a lot of the Olympic weightlifting and more explosive stuff because that's been a real weakness of mine my entire life. Some plyometric work, some of the heavy strength stuff. That's where I thrive, is more of like the low rep range strength stuff. But yeah, I recently, like over the last couple of years, speaking to another thing that like I've changed my mind on, I've recognized the value of doing more cardiovascular stuff. And I've developed a real love and appreciation, I guess, for longer bouts of aerobic work. So that's something that I've recently dabbled in, and we'll probably do some longer races again in the future, but I just don't have anything on the schedule right now.
Yeah. Listeners of this podcast will know that that's the current era that I'm in of paying back years of cardio slander. Well, maybe I wasn't slandering, but maybe I just wasn't speaking anything as much as I should have about cardio. And so I owe. And so that's certainly the phase of life I'm in. I think that's a classic like arc of somebody's training career and age, you know, where you're like, I'm not in my 20s. I'm, you know, starting to think about long-term health. I'm starting to think about maybe, you know, what's best for me long-term, diversifying things, trying something new. And so I suppose we're something of a cliche there, but I think it's still a really good thing.
Well, and I think especially like our generation, we were so big on like advocating for resistance training because it was so underutilized by the general public that we were so gung-ho about that because it was done at like the prevalence of those who actually did resistance training was so much lower than those who did cardiovascular exercise that we sort of like had to obsess over it for a little bit almost to let the pendulum swing back. So to show a little compassion towards us, I think that's why. But yeah, we're all coming back around finally.
Totally, totally. All right, you're not getting off the hook. What's something that you do or don't do that you know you should but are still working on?
Sleep is mine. I have a very bad habit of working myself into the ground because I really enjoy working. It's very fulfilling to me. So I tend to not be able to sleep super well, not prioritize it as well as I should. It's easy for me to sacrifice for other things. And then I end up getting sick or like horribly injured. And that's usually the reason why.
It's funny because I feel that way too, right? It's easily could be my answer as well. I don't on paper, like the recommendation. If you're like, hey, Jordan, how much sleep should somebody get? Whatever that recommendation is, 7 to 9 hours or whatever. Like, I don't get that. I don't remember the last time I got that. Years. But like, that's not an endorsement. Neither of us are saying you should do that. But I actually don't currently, as of right now, regret those choices. So it's like, it's you know, I'm currently not trying to improve that. It is something that I don't do well enough, and I admit, but it's something that I rationalize trading away for a small percentage. It's not like I'm not sleeping. It's not like we're friggin' pulling all-nighters or anything like that, but it's something where I'm like, hey, to get that seventh hour of sleep, like, I'd rather my in order for me to do the things I want to do, whatever those things are, and reflect my values, like right now, that's something that I'm just choosing not to do. So it sounds like yours is more also a choice where it's like, you know, maybe I'd like to get more, but the way my values are lined up right now, this is the trade-off I'm making.
Yeah. And I think like I try to strike a somewhat reasonable balance with it, where if I'm like really irresponsible for a couple of days and I really don't sleep well, I try to reprioritize it like over the next couple of days and let it all balance out. But yes, right now it's a sacrifice I'm comfortable making. Yep. Cause yeah, it's not It's not awful, but it's also just not great.
Yeah, let's pivot to our first topic, which I've really enjoyed is reaching out to my podcast guests and just asking them very close to the episode is like what's something that they're currently really passionate about. And you know what? I'm not going to preface it. I'm going to let you preface it. I want you to tell me what you told me, and then I want us to dive into it.
Okay, I don't remember exactly how I worded this
Okay.
when I first responded to you. But something that I've learned through the fact that like the way that I approach content recently seems to be landing with a certain demographic. I've learned that a lot of people I think are getting a little bit sick of being told of concepts being explained to them in very simplistic, very actionable ways, but without a sufficient explanation as to why or how. And I think a lot of people in our shoes have also experienced the flip side of that, where people come to us and they're like, well, just tell me what to do. Just give me the answers. Stop with all this nuanced stuff. And so you kind of have to like thread a very close needle there. But I think there's a tremendous amount of value in getting buy-in from people by having them at least experience like a surface level understanding as to the reasons why we're making certain recommendations, because otherwise it's just like it's more information and more advice that they're receiving from this void where there's so much of the same stuff. And if you can't properly explain why you're recommending something, I don't think that is going to cut it for people anymore. And I'm glad that that's the case, but that's something I'm really passionate about, is not just dumbing stuff down because the public doesn't have the background understanding. Like, let's actually deliver that and let's give more people access to at least parts of the education that we've received, because that's honestly our job is to be able to communicate that effectively, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think knowing what I'm hearing from you is that in your experience, having just learning a little bit about why you might be doing something is going to help you do that thing. I think you and I might fall into a category of like, yeah, for me, that's almost a linear relationship. It's like there's like no very small, like, I don't know if there's a tail to that at all, where the more I learn about it, the more reason why it's important, the ins and outs of it, the more excited I get about something, the more buy-in I have for it. For me to get into cardio several years ago, my plan was hire the smartest person I know, spend money to meet with this person a lot, and ask a never-ending list of information or questions to gather as much. Like, that's not everyone's MO, but I think what you're saying is the default of like, yeah, n nobody wants to know all that stuff. Don't bore them with all the explanations. Just tell them what to do is unlikely going to get your best results with somebody. And in fact, people might actually be able to handle a bit more, and they might benefit from a bit more if you don't just dumb everything down and you give them a bit of an explanation.
Yeah, and I think especially now, because information is so readily available, people are, I get asked this question all the time. People are kind of struggling to determine which advice to listen to, like which advice is credible. And I think that's where having a sufficient explanation can set the real, like people who actually know what they're talking about, apart from the people who are maybe just like echoing what they've heard from others or things they've seen who maybe aren't. And the concept of qualifications gets messy because, like, what technically is a sufficient qualification? But at a certain point, if you ask questions, if you ask why, and someone cannot give you an answer, but they're like aggressively standing behind this piece of advice that they're delivering, I think like my ears turn off at that point. I'm the person that asks why an annoying amount of times, and eventually, like it's perfectly acceptable to say, well, I don't know why. Like, let me look into that. Let me try to understand it better. That's absolutely fine and respectable. But it's like if your parents tell you to do something and you're like, but why? And they don't give you any sort of response. They kind of lose a little bit of credibility in that context, in my experience.
Yeah, it's definitely less motivating to hear because I said so, or because this is good, it's good, do it. That's slightly less motivating than describing to somebody why fiber is important, or why eating enough protein is important, or why doing some cardio is important. What are some examples that either on social media or working directly with people or students where you've where this going the extra mile to explain something has paid off?
I think generally where that's most necessary is when it when it challenges somebody in terms of what they're already doing, like maybe the cardio concept. Like if I'm trying to explain to someone why cardio is different than lifting weights mechanistically, like they need to understand that those are completely separate aspects of physiology, and neglecting one is not, it's not necessarily responsible. It's definitely not optimal. As opposed to just being like, well, I said so because I have a PhD and because I'm a coach or whatever. Especially, and this kind of gets into stuff that we'll probably talk about in greater depth, but especially in working with people who maybe have a specific goal that maybe a lot of prerequisite work needs to go into being able to then approach that goal responsibly. Like, for example, fat loss in maybe women who have been like chronically dieting for their entire lives, they oftentimes don't really want to hear from me that we can't do that right this second. And it's taken me years to fine-tune that explanation and to like understand how to communicate that in a way that it's less scary. And I think fear is a big thing that has to be overcome through these explanations, and then just any sort of resistance mentally with the person on the receiving end.
I'm gonna do a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of smack talk without naming names at all. There's a person who does something similar to me who, in their like kind of layout for their programming, there's like a whole bunch of, it's like, hey, if you have a question about this, like, don't even bother being here. Like, you're supposed to just trust me and do what I say. And I have people come to my offering all the time being like, wow, it's so great you answer this question and explain it to me. I'm like, there are people out there not answering your question and explaining it to you. And so, you know, I'm from a business perspective thankful that there are some people out there who will say, shut up and just do what I say because I said it, because it makes people who are willing to take an extra second to explain it do a bit better. I always crack up, like, first time I ever met, I don't know, Jordan Syatt, one of the things I'll never forget, one of the things that we were talking about was that, like, people often say that, like, the coaching space is super saturated. And, like, he looked at me square in the face. He's like, it's saturated with bad coaches. Like, and so, like, you don't need to be worried about the fact that there are a lot of coaches because most people are not willing to think about things and go the extra mile and try to create buy-in and explain something to somebody. So, yeah, that's really awesome. Has there ever been a time where you feel like you went overboard, that you feel like you've overexplained something? Like, how do we thread that needle? How do you know what's the right amount of information to create buy-in without, you know, some sort of losing somebody along the way of like, oh, this is just so complicated, I can't grasp it?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it depends so heavily on your audience, and that's kind of where you have to, I think, like social awareness really comes into play, and that's something that I've had to learn by literally teaching in front of a group of undergraduate students who are staring back at me, and I can see in their eyes if I've lost them. And if I've, and you have to kind of check in periodically in that setting and be like, okay, like, is this making sense? Do I need to backtrack? Let me explain this differently. And so that's a skill I've been lucky to have that sort of exposure with, because it's helped me tremendously in being able to pick up on those things. But it again really comes down to your audience. Like in a one-on-one setting, I have generally attracted people who ask a lot of questions and who like are very intelligent. They work in healthcare. They have interest in these things. And so I'm always like, look, this is like a whole curriculum. We can kind of bounce back and forth. I want you to walk away from this learning as much as you possibly can. I will too. And I love that vibe. I love that sort of interaction. But there are definitely some people who want a level of depth where I'm sending them studies and I'm citing everything that I'm saying. And then there's some people who just want me to be able to kind of explain very generally the overarching mechanism or whatever's going on at play. And so that you kind of have to like read the room a little bit, which is not a sufficient answer to generalize, but that's a skill that you sort of develop over time, I think, just with talking to enough people, and especially in those one-on-one interactions.
Totally. I think knowing your audience is the answer of like, hey, you know how deep to go because you know who you're talking to. You have like PhD students in your class, like you're going deep on a mechanistic level. You have a gen pop, you might lean into more of like an outcomes-based thing. It's like, hey, fiber's better for you because you have less heart disease and you live longer. You know, you might go more of the these are the outcomes, you know? And so I think that knowing your audience is a really good one. I also think, like, man, like have some charisma and excitement around what you're explaining. Like, if you bring some excitement around it, oftentimes I'll be on a call with a client and they'll ask a question and I'll be like, you didn't necessarily ask me to go in this depth, but I think it's super duper cool. And then the explanation that follows, at least you've brought some sort of excitement to it. I think that has nothing to do with the information, but and everything to do with how you're presenting it. But I think if you're passionate about something and you're excited and you're charismatic about it, I think it lands better and helps people get excited about, you know, giving them a reason, a why to do something is important. Like, I think coaching is in air quotes. Coaching could be teaching, could be actual like fitness coaching. I mean, it could be just communicating to a friend. Like, it's about knowing your audience, but it's also about getting that person excited to do this thing they might not have previously been excited to do.
100%. And I think if anyone were to think back about like their education growing up, I think most of us can think of an example where we were in a class on a specific subject that we didn't have that much interest in at baseline, but because the teacher was so passionate or so cool or so enthusiastic, it sort of like turned on this level of interest that we may not have expected. I know I experienced that like dozens of times. And that's kind of the role that we are responsible for playing in these dynamics is, hey, we find this super cool and fun. And that's what makes it so easy for us to continue doing. So it's our job to make that as contagious as possible, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I think that is super. If we think back to like teachers that made an impact on us, I bet it had more to do with how the person was doing something than what subject it was.
Yeah. And even just like the human aspect, like it's not just about the information and the content. It's okay to work in some personal stories every now and again when that's appropriate, or like use yourself as an example, or pull up like a funny meme from social media that's relevant to the content at hand. Like, it's important to humanize it too. I think that's usually a piece that sort of connects with the whole passion thing. Because at the end of the day, like if you're only seen as an authority figure, that also kind of creates a weird dynamic. So you have to be both an authority figure and a person.
Yep, I love that. I love that. I want to talk about fueling. I think if you were to copy and paste your Instagram link into like ChatGPT and be like, what's this person talk about quite often? I would bet that the word fueling, you know, sufficiently for exercise, those sorts of words would come up. And so I want to start with a butchered quote. You said, women were robbed of the dreamer bulk all the high school boys got to do back in the day. If you want to build a fat ass, you need to be as committed to that as high school boys are to building big arms. Elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of those hard pills to swallow, I think, especially with female audiences, because our introduction to all of this stuff is so bizarre because we're kind of like inundated with a lot of conflicting messaging. And like, for example, my upbringing into strength training was like a weird hybridization of my high school boyfriend's experience with like strength conditioning coaches mixed with my mom's like slim fast shakes in the pantry. And you kind of get this messaging of like, well, this is how you train. This is the smart way of doing things. But also you need to focus on like getting smaller and eating less and really tightly controlling the food side of things, especially. And so many women that we talk to, they want to have a certain level of muscle mass that they may not even realize. They may describe it as like tone or definition or what have you, but most women want a big butt. Most women want like shoulders that look pretty nice in dresses and whatnot, and like a small waist, all those things. And I think what gets missed is the fact that like having a big butt, that's a lot of muscle mass. That's a tremendous amount of mass. And you have to feed that mass in order for it to ever like come into existence in the first place. And I do think that we're sort of like robbed of that introduction where it's like, okay, yeah, we're going to train hard, but we're also going to eat hard to support that. And I think that sets such a strong foundation that I wish more women were kind of exposed to that early in their experience. But even if it's coming in later, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. If it happens to somebody at all, I think that that's great. I think speaking as that high school boy whose main goal in life was to build big arms, there was an element of like, I know this whole conversation is wrapped in a, it's just different for men and women societally at that age from a, you know, men and big going together as like, you know, from a society perspective, a positive thing, and women and big from a society perspective, not coming with a positive connotation. And that's fucked up. Yes. So we're wrapping this whole conversation in that. But it certainly was the case where it was just like, oh, I want to grow these muscles. And if I ever want to like be lean and shredded, that was something I would think about down the road. But it's, I want to eat to grow these muscles. I want to train to grow these muscles. It's important. And if I'm growing everything along the way and I get a little bit bigger, it was worth it at 16, 17, 18 years old to make that stuff happen. And I think, you know, it's a generalization, but I think a lot of men who have been lifting since that time can probably cast themselves back to those years of all that mattered was getting big. And that's why I'm big 20 years later, is because I had the period of it didn't matter about being super shredded or, you know, being super defined. It mattered to eat and train to grow. And if you've never, if you're a woman, if you've just never had any period of your life that was like that, and you are still yearning after many years to grow your muscles, like that kind of tracks.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's sad at some points to see, but I think there's also like tremendous opportunity there, because sometimes, for example, I happen to work out at the same time as these high school girls who are like volleyball players. And so I'll overhear little conversations about like, I want to get toned. I want to like lose fat around my midsection. I want to have visible abs. And these are athletes. They're already in great shape. Like they have nothing to worry about. But then at the same breath, they know who I am. And they'll say things like, I want to look like Emily when I'm older. And then it's my job to communicate the fact that like, I eat like a high school boy. I eat a lot. I've trained really hard for over a decade at this point. Don't focus on getting smaller if you want to end up like me, or whatever example that might be for others. And so I think, thankfully, I think there are more women who prioritize like strength and muscle and those aspects of fitness now for those girls to look up to. But I think the messaging still has to kind of get through to all of us sometimes, where if we want something to grow anything, we have to feed it. Like that's one of the unavoidable prerequisites. So that's what I'm trying to get across before we worry about leanness, which can always, of course, come into play.
Yeah. And this, we've answered a bit of this, but I'm going to ask more directly, which is, how do we reconcile this messaging of, I will say it in an annoying way, this like rah, rah, eat more, with the fact that statistically most of us eat too much?
Yeah. And I think that's the confusing piece to everybody, is like, why are you telling me to eat more when everyone's overweight and obese? Like that's obviously not the answer. I think the piece that maybe gets missed in that conversation when it's communicated on social media, especially in those like really brief formats, is the fact that the fixation on eating less is sometimes exactly what contributes to overeating in the long term. And what I mean by that is, I see all the time, I look at women's food logs over the course of a week, and I do a week for this exact reason, because there will be days where they're eating, they're not lying to me, like 1100 calories, 1000 calories, what have you. And then the weekend will come and they're starving, and they're like angry about the fact that they've been under eating the entire week. And then it's easy to eat like 3,000-4,000 calories, especially if you're going out and if you're including alcohol. And I think it's easy to forget that like our appetite also responds to our behavior. So if we're under eating for so many days by such an extreme margin, it's going to be really hard to control appetite in the subsequent days. And all of it sort of feeds into itself in that manner. And I think what most women have missed is giving themselves an opportunity to consistently and intentionally make sure that they are eating enough to at least maintain their current body weight. I'm not saying that everyone has to enter some crazy surplus, gain a bunch of body fat, be super unhappy with themselves. But I don't think most women realize like the amount of sporadic consumption that goes on when they're not paying super close attention. And if they were to just commit to a period of making sure that they're checking the boxes for like several months, it will set them up so much better for success in the long term.
It's super insightful, because you could have said that this message isn't for everyone, and it's meant primarily for a subset of a fitness bubble within a bubble of already lean and healthy people trying to get like toned and shredded. Like toned and shredded are like privileged statements that imply someone's already at a healthy body weight and they're seeking more. You could have said that. You didn't say that. And what you said instead, I think, is that even if you're technically overweight or you have obesity, there's still good stuff to take away from the abundance philosophy, the eat enough philosophy, the take some time away from a restrictive mindset philosophy. And so I really like that, because I do think you're right. It's like that person might not need the part of this chat that is like a small calorie surplus, or like, you know, they might not need that in particular, but you are right. Where like there are most people who have gained weight over time have had plenty of periods of being restrictive and maybe being so restrictive that it backfired. And there is an element of like, there's a portion of this chat here, which is, it can be a mindset piece of fueling sufficiently, getting away from the pursuit of being smaller for a bit of time to heal relationship with food and habits and body and training and all that stuff, build some muscle, gain fitness. So I really like that answer. Really well said.
I think it would shock the majority of people. And this is just something that I've gathered from working with hundreds of individuals on nutrition specifically. I think it would shock most that even people who are struggling with their weight and who are objectively like falling in the criteria for obesity, for example, it's not that they like, a lot of the time those individuals have the most restrictive mindsets towards food. And even if the outcome doesn't necessarily match up with that in the perception of most people, like you were saying, a lot of the time it boils down to just like, have you ever given yourself permission to not be super restrictive and to not like approach all these insane fad diets like as a means of controlling everything so tightly? And so I think it's, I say enough for a reason. I'm not telling you to eat too much. I'm not telling you that you need to become overweight in this process, but enough is an important starting point, I think, for most people.
Yeah, there's, the statistics on this are not perfect, but there's something like the average person has tried to lose weight like at least 7 times or something. You know, there's some statistics out there floating around, but let's use that random statistic of 7 times. That's like, depending on how long that is, that could be 7 times over a decade. And that can, and even if you're not trying to lose weight at this exact moment, it can consume your mind a bit. And so taking some time away from the pursuit of weight loss, even if you're not doing it, you're always thinking about it. I find it's a cliche, but I find the focus on performance to be a really nice distraction. And, you know, you can take the pursuit of performance to a disordered place too, and it can be a negative in your life for sure. But I suspect for most, it's a positive shift from trying to get smaller. Have you found that as well?
Yeah, I 100% agree. And especially like in some of those uncomfortable stages where someone might be eating a little bit more on a daily basis, at least like in an intentional way, than they've been comfortable eating previously. Even if their body composition isn't changing in a negative manner, like that just messes with people's heads a little bit. And even just feeling more full throughout the day and those little things, and having something else to focus on that's positive and where they can objectively see that they are becoming more powerful, more capable, and that builds a tremendous amount of confidence, and it can make that discomfort feel a lot less scary.
That's awesome. I want to talk about some basic fueling. I say basic, but we can get as nerdy as we want. Basic fueling strategies for different types of workouts that people are doing. If you want to add or subtract from these buckets, you can. But I suspect the things that people are doing and considering fueling for are the 30 to 60 minute lift, the 30 to 60 to 90 minute lift, we'll say, right? So the up to an hour lift and the up to 2 hour lift, the up to an hour run and the greater than 1 hour run. And I say run, but just any cardio bout, you know, you're on the bike, elliptical, stairs, whatever. So we have, let's say, a shorter lift and a longer lift, a shorter run and a longer run. How do we think about fueling for these types of workouts?
Yeah, so I think probably the best way to frame this is to maybe just introduce very broadly the concept of like glycogen being utilized as kind of our main source of energy during most of these kinds of training, kind of depending on the intensity. We can get more into that. But the 90 minute mark is what's traditionally spoken to in terms of like, when do you need to actually worry about like fuel availability? When are glycogen stores going to potentially be tapped during something like the lift? That's generally around the 90 minute mark is kind of like the rule of thumb, but that depends, of course, on an individual's capacity to store glycogen, which is essentially just the stored form of carbohydrate, just so that that's like clear. And that'll depend on like your size, your muscle mass, et cetera. So people can store different amounts that might last different durations of time, et cetera. So that's why a lot of the time you'll hear, like, you don't really need to worry about fueling for something like a normal 60 to 90 minute lift. However, I do sometimes push back against that a little bit, not because it's going to kill you if you like go into a training session like that fasted, especially for like my early morning people, which I'm among that crowd. It's sometimes easier to just like roll into the gym and not have to worry about eating anything beforehand. However, it's almost never going to hurt to, is kind of my opinion, especially because even if we're just talking about glycogen depletion, that doesn't happen in like a predictable and uniform way. So over the course of like a 60-minute lift, because glycogen is stored locally in the muscle tissue that's going to be utilizing that substrate, you can have certain muscle groups that are fully tapped within that hour and then others that are not touched. And so on average, it ends up being like maybe 40 to 60% depletion, but introducing more substrate isn't necessarily going to hurt almost ever. So I usually recommend that people think about at least like carbs and protein around something like a standard lift.
Can I pause you really
If
quickly
you,
just to talk about this amount of glycogen depletion? And just for the listener, just like
yeah.
you might say, well, the muscle glycogen, total muscle glycogen is depleted somewhere in 40 to 60%. Like, but what that sounds like is, oh, you have a lot left. But it is not the case that just, you know, only at zero muscle glycogen does your body start to feel the effects of lowering muscle glycogen. Like this is a, you know, f fatigue is it obviously a complicated thing we're not going to dive too much into today, but it's a lot of it's basically just a lot of feedback from your body to your brain that governs, you know, your ability to produce force and all of these things. And so you starting to lose a chunk of muscle glycogen is sufficient to signal, you know, to have some sort of fatigue signal to the brain and reduce performance, increase RP, whatever. So you saying, hey, you know, muscle glycogen only depletes 40, 60, like, and I know you meant this as well. I'm just saying that that's sufficient to start to feel the effects of that. It's not like your gas tank in your car where like it runs the same way until it's on zero. It is the case that these things are, you know, sort of a continuum where as it happens more, you're feeling the effects of that.
100%, that's yes, 100%. That is the case. And I think I don't remember specifically like the exact studies or anything, but I know that performance detriments have been observed at like over the course of a normal training session with that level of glycogen depletion. So that's why like my argument is usually why not? Because just anecdotally, anyone who I've had consume like a little bit of carbohydrate before or sometimes during if it's a longer lift, almost universally report feeling better. And it's usually towards the end of a session when you're typically feeling a little bit gassed that you're actually still able to have at least better output than you would have without it. And RPE and like the mental aspect is interesting. And that's something that not everyone recognizes is that there's like the localized fatigue and then there's also central fatigue. And the brain utilizes carbohydrates, so it's very sensitive to changes in substrate availability, and it will signal to the rest of the body, like, hey, we need to pump the brakes. So a lot of that again gets kind of missed in the blanket statements of like, well, you don't need to worry about that for a lift because you only deplete partially these glycogen stores. So yes, I love that you touched on that essentially.
What do you find it to be the biggest hurdle for getting clients or just speaking with people on social media to get them to fuel their training? And by say fuel your
I
training could be we could be talking about pre-workout nutrition and let's just say intra workout nutrition. We'll lump those two together. We can talk about post-workout nutrition, I suppose, but I mean more specifically eating before you lift or run or eating before you run slash during a run.
I think there are a few buckets of barriers that people run into. One of them being like the convenience and the time constraint piece, which there are easy ways to circumvent that don't always come to mind immediately. But like I was saying, I'm an early morning exerciser personally. It's real easy to just drink some orange juice on the way
Dude,
to the gym or.
I'm so happy you said orange juice. We are team OJ here. Keep going, keep going. Amazing. Love it.
Orange juice, like dried fruit, throw some honey in your coffee. There are such simple ways of circumventing that issue. So that one can be overcome. I would recommend people try it, even if they claim to feel better fasted. GI complaints are another one, and that also can be overcome by having an understanding of like what types of foods make sense to consume and what proximity to the training session. For example, you don't necessarily want to have a meal that's like super high in fiber or in fats if you're going to be training within like an hour of consuming that meal. And that's a good case for the simpler sources like orange juice, or giving yourself more time if you can. So that's an aspect of it. And also like the more that you sort of train the gut to tolerate food in that in that context, the better it will sometimes get to an extent. The third would be sort of like the mental aspect of, while I'm exercising, especially those with body composition goals, I'm exercising, and part of the reason I'm doing that is to expend energy and to burn calories. So why am I going to potentially interrupt like acute fat oxidation, for example? If in my mind I think I'm burning fat during this workout, that doesn't make sense to me to introduce food during that time. And I think that kind of boils down to just a fundamental misunderstanding of how fat loss works chronically. Because it just doesn't make sense to worry about that acutely, because the body compensates throughout the rest of the day, and there's all these other processes that sort of offset whatever you're doing acutely during that session and whatever substrates you're utilizing. So as long as you're in a sustained deficit, fat loss isn't something that you have to, again, like hyperfixate on that specific window in regards to.
Yeah, those are great ones. I think somewhat tangentially to that last one is the very simple, like, I don't want to spend my calories then. Like I'll have to eat less later. If someone's like, "Hey, I have 1500 to 1700 calories and you're telling me to have 100 to 200 before or during when I'm training," like that's not even a time where I'm yearning for calories. And so I'm taking calories from other moments where I feel like I'm going to be definitely hungry to putting them during training where I might not experience hunger. It's like, wouldn't it make the most sense to spend my calories when I'm the most hungry? Now, that to me is when I c confront is sounds too aggressive, but I come up against quite often of, and I find myself coming to a conclusion of try it. And if you care, like I guess the more I would encourage you to fuel your training, the more you care about the outcome of that training from a performance standpoint. So if you are a person who's running and cares about your performance, if you're a person who's lifting and you care about not just your performance, but the adaptations you'd get from performing well, the more I'd recommend you put some calories there. And I almost want to just be like, "Hey, those calories don't exist. Just freaking do it if it's going to help you." But of course they exist, and I find myself with clients who are more performance driven, more outcome of that performance driven, encouraging this more. And I want to talk a little bit about how much, because you said, "Hey, it won't hurt. You don't need much." But probably, like you said, convenience and habitual diet probably reign supreme. But let's talk a little bit about how much. Because I do think people are like, okay, maybe I can get past the calorie thing as long as it's X amount. And so let's talk a bit about how much do I need to eat to get what sort of potential benefit, and then I can decide if it's worth it.
Yeah. And of course, that answer will also vary a little bit based on the person and their size and like their calorie allotments slash needs throughout the day. I would say, generally speaking, if you're talking, and it also depends on like what time of day are you training? Have you already had a couple of meals in you? Because if that's the case, you honestly don't need to worry about this to the same extent as if you're going into your workout fasted from the day before. If that's the case, I think introducing like my general just like number that I'll throw out that again lacks a certain level of nuance, but about 30 grams of carbs would be sufficient in most cases. And if you're doing a really extended bout, like a long run or something that's going to take you upwards of 2 hours, that's when you want to start introducing the intra nutrition, which at minimum you want like 30 to 60 grams an hour. Again, at minimum, we see performance improvements at higher rates, but again, that's sometimes a hard selling point, which I understand.
Keep going.
In terms of like framing it across a day, I think this can sometimes be helpful and a little bit more individualized. I like to think about like sandwiching your session in this whole pre-intra post-workout window, trying to get about 60% of your carbs for the day in that window, if possible. Now, if you don't have that many carbs to work with, okay, let's just still try to prioritize them around that window to the extent that you can. That also leaves, and this kind of speaks to your earlier point, room for strategy when it comes to like playing around with more or less satiating foods. Because if we're prioritizing maybe more of our simpler carbs in that proportion, we can also then prioritize higher fat and potentially higher fiber meals in those remaining ones throughout the day, which also happen to be more satiating. So you can kind of play around with timing a little bit, with meal composition a little bit to try and make this work in a way that isn't insufferable to you. Because if you are miserable and starving, that I would argue is going to affect you more negatively.
Totally. I think that I'd start with, it's probably with a bit of a binary thought of like just having anything, having a bit of something, a glass, a serving of orange juice, 100 calories, you know, like, you know, again, it could be a banana. It could be like, once you're, if my client's like, hey, I'll do this, I'll try this, you know, I'll try like a rice cake with jelly on it or something. It's like, all right, great. Like, start with a binary, like try having something. And is there a threshold at which it needs to get to become meaningful? The answer is I'm not really sure, because we have mouth rinsing, you know, studies where people rinse and spit carbohydrates and see performance increases. So if that's like barely ingesting any of the carbohydrates, if that can potentially maybe be helpful, then let's think of this as binary. And whatever you feel like, you're like, oh, a lot, 50 calories. It's like, okay, let's try it. I will personally underscore my take to be, if personally, and to be that I recommend people who consistently train fasted to at least experiment with small bits of carbohydrate before slash during, depending on the length of the training session, and try it for a few workouts and see if you notice a bit of a difference. Because, you know, if you do it just something one time, you can be overwhelmed by other acute factors that mess up your performance on that day. And, you know, it didn't mean anything. Oh, it maybe perform worse. It's like, no, you weren't hydrated yesterday or something, right? And so give it a week of trying to fuel your workouts. Shuffle your calories throughout the, you know, your distribution a little bit. Make some room. Have 50 to 100 calories before, right before, during, whatever. And then make a call. And if you honestly feel no difference and you find it easier to adhere and you enjoy your life more when you don't have those calories, then like, I'm not going to put up a fight. Would you concur?
100%. I don't think it's not something, yes, I like to stress the importance of this because I think a lot of people underestimate it, but it's not going to like make or break your training adaptations, but to any extent. And yet also to your point, you said like, try it for a week. See how you feel. I also find sometimes, and this is like a funny just thing that I've noticed, sometimes people don't notice when they do it, but then they notice when they go back to not doing it. So pay attention when you introduce the food to how you feel during your sessions. But if you decide you didn't notice anything, go back to not doing it and see if you notice like detriments, because I find a lot of the time that's when it will sort of click for people.
Let's talk about that long session, maybe even specifically that long cardio bout. A lot of recommendations are thrown around of carbohydrates per hour. Could we speak to, and I crack up, I know there's one of my clients listening who just did a half marathon, and we had some nice chats around fueling, trying to get her to fuel a little bit more. Let's just talk about what are some of the general recommendations out there. And maybe you had a really great post, I don't know if it was recently or it was pinned or I scrolled a bit down, about why ingesting carbohydrates still matters for exercise at which the intensity is more governed by fat oxidation, where you're burning more fat. If you're doing an exercise that's low enough intensity where you're burning more fat for fuel, why might it still be important to be ingesting carbohydrates during that exercise?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest argument is the fact that you're never exclusively burning fat. And that's also something that I think gets miscommunicated in our space a lot, is just that there's like this switch where when intensity changes, when it becomes, you know, more aerobic, lower intensity, that fat oxidation switches on and that's all that's happening. But the way that our metabolism functions, it's constantly fluxing. Carbohydrates and fats are constantly contributing to different proportions with one another. So you're never exclusively relying on fats. And especially in these like longer duration events, one of the ideas with continuously consuming carbohydrates is the fact that you then get to spare your precious glycogen, which is valuable, because if you're running for 2, 3, 4 hours, that will deplete your glycogen stores at a certain point. And you want to be able to preserve that for longer into the session if you can. You want to be able to avoid becoming fully depleted. And because the brain relies on carbohydrates, so it's a good direct source, so that you don't have the same like fatigue experience that relates to the way the nervous system governs fatigue. So there's a lot of reasons, realistically speaking. I think the biggest one is just the fact that you're never exclusively utilizing fats. And the carbohydrates are always productive in terms of what we found from a performance standpoint.
What are some of the general recommendations for someone who's starting to explore some longer cardio bouts? And where might you find that cutoff of like, maybe it's not that important for this context, but it starts to be important for this context, and here's how much?
Yeah, I would say it becomes important almost ubiquitously, kind of at that 90-minute mark, is when I have people start introducing intra-run fuel. The recommendation in terms of a starting point has traditionally been like that 30 to 60 grams per hour range. More like emerging evidence is suggesting that people tend to do even better with like 60 to 90, and we're seeing even upwards of 90 at this point being productive. That's more, I would say, in like an elite context. I don't think the average person necessarily needs to be consuming 100 grams of carbs an hour during a run. However, again, it's one of those things that's maybe worth experimenting with, and it's something that I advise clients to work up over time. Like, don't start with 90 grams of carbs per hour. That's when a lot of the time we'll experience the GI effects, because your gut just isn't used to tolerating having to digest things at that intensity even. So I usually have people kind of start at the lower end of the range, gradually work up, especially because in the context of racing, we find that a lot of the time people stop ingesting as much as they become more fatigued and as maybe GI issues arise. So towards the end of an event, people tend to be worse about consuming fuel. So if you can train yourself to tolerate higher amounts, I recommend starting events at those higher amounts with the understanding that you're probably going to titrate down as the event goes on. That's kind of my general recommendation with planning for like a race setting and accounting for that in the way that you train your gut throughout the training block. I sort of went off on a tangent. There
No,
was
it's good.
something else I
It's
was going
good.
to say. So please get me back on track if you
Yeah,
need to.
for sure. You're great. I love tangents. And anybody listening, listen, anybody's here an hour and 6 minutes in, they're up for some tangents. They're up for some rabbit holes. So that's great. One of the things I find super interesting about fueling is like, let's say I raced a 10K a couple like a month ago, let's say. And like in that hour range, you just like from a racing context, you're not taking in any fuel during the race. But the minute you go up to like a half marathon, not only do you need to start fueling, but you need to start fueling early. So it's counterintuitive. It's not like, oh, I'm running twice as long, and so I should start to fuel as I get past that hour mark. It's like, no. Once your workout is 90 plus minutes, you need to start fueling early to support the work you're going to be doing 90 minutes from now. And so it is a bit, it's funny. It's like, hey, if you think it's because you need to fuel the second half. It's like you do, but you start doing that early on.
Yeah, it's not like you necessarily get access to it right away. So that's part of it. And I find, like, I live in Arizona, for example. So this is
Oh, you're sweating like
partially
crazy.
personal experience. And then partially, like, what the evidence has also suggested, once you enter like a more stressful context, physiologically speaking, with heat and with altitude being probably the most relevant to, I find that I do better with even more carbohydrate than I typically would. And then you also have to play around with like the hydration piece and the sodium piece. And a lot of that has to become pretty individualized. But I found that like my winter running needs like a certain fueling strategy. And then my summer running needs a whole other one. And it's a lot more than I would prefer to be consuming, if I'm being honest.
What do we know about post-workout? And I say workout, I mean either a really long workout, like a lift, or a really hard cardio session, or a long cardio session. So speaking about exercise that fueling makes more of a difference for, we'll say, as a catch-all for like longer and harder workouts. What do we know about post-workout carbohydrate intake?
Yeah, we know that it's also productive, which is why I sort of gave that like 60% sort of surrounding your session suggestion. Now, in terms of like the exact window, it's not something that I say people need to stress themselves out over in terms of like consuming it within an hour exactly. I usually tell people within a couple hours, try to consume a meal that's pretty high in carbohydrates, pretty high in protein. I don't even have people worry quite as much about like the fiber and the fat contribution in that window. I just also don't recommend emphasizing them specifically. But we do know that like carbohydrates and protein sort of complement one another in terms of the signaling involved for recovery specifically. So like the presence of carbs kind of facilitates protein synthesis, and then or the presence of protein supports like glycogen replenishment happening a little bit more efficiently. So from a recovery standpoint, having the two kind of along for the ride with one another is valuable. But again, it's not something that you have to like obsess over having immediately if that's not super convenient for you.
I think also it matters when your next training session is. And so You know, if you're someone listening and you're like, hey, I lift 3 or 4 days a week and I do some walking, like, it's not crucial that you have post-exercise carbohydrate. Your next time in which you really would want to be utilizing those carbohydrates is so far away that you're going to be fine. But in an extreme example, of course, if you're training again later that day, this is super crucial. And I'd go as far as to say, if you train again tomorrow in a way that would be affected by your fueling and recovery status. So this is me. So I'm talking about me. I used to lift 3 or 4 days a week and I'd walk. And, you know, my consensus was, okay, like glycogen replenishment, by the time I work out again in 24 to 48 hours, like, I'm going to be fine. Like, my glycogen will be back. Even if I don't have carbs right after I lift, or I have a little bit of carbs, I'll have several meals between now and next session. And so I'll be back. The thing that changed my mind was obviously starting doing running and lifting on alternating days. So my next workout where I might benefit from being better recovered is always tomorrow, essentially. There was a study in 2024 that changed my mind, at least nudged me to taking this a little bit more seriously. If you're someone who trains very frequently, it was like nine people, I think they were cyclists, crossover study, matched for carbohydrate. They were having a lot of carbs, and not a lot of carbs for a regular person, maybe not a lot of carbs for an endurance athlete. Yeah. It was like 7 grams per kilogram, which for me, that's like 600 grams of carbs, let's say. There was a crossover study, and so they matched for carbohydrate, but one group delayed carbohydrate intake for 3 hours post-exercise. So at the three-hour mark, that's when they had their next carbohydrate meal, and the other group over the course of the 3 hours post-exercise had, I think, 3 grams per kilogram, which should be like 250 to 300 for me. So same amount of carbohydrates from one workout to the next, but one group had it, you know, a large or a significant percentage of those right after training. And what they saw was that glycogen stores at the next exercise bout were similar. Basically, like, you've replenished your glycogen and you've replenished your glycogen because you've had enough carbs between sessions. You're in the same place, but performance was different. The group that had the carbohydrates sooner after training performed better, even though glycogen was the same. And that was like me scratching my head. I was like, I used to believe that as long as glycogen's good, like, you're good. It seems like there's something happening in that short post-exercise window. Maybe it's liver glycogen replenishment and how that influences other signaling. You know, again, you and I talked earlier in this chat of like how deep you might want to understand something. And I'm interested in why that might be happening, but I'm also interested in that it's happening. And so I will end this monologue with, like, the more frequently you train, the more intensely that you train, the more performance driven that you are, these sorts of little things can matter. Total carbohydrate intake, post-training carbohydrate intake, pre and intra carbohydrate intake, and protein, of course, can matter. But that study really, again, it's just one study, tiny study, nine people. It's not like I'm make or break, but it has helped me put that into practice. Like we talked about, hey, having that extra piece of information for me, or even that hypothesis, got me to push my carbohydrate intake intra and post training higher, and have been able to handle much higher training volumes than ever before, and feeling good along the way. So that's my little story there.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, anecdotally, I think I've experienced this too. I think most people who begin taking up running or any form of aerobic exercise that's comparable, you kind of go through this process of realizing that you're not eating enough afterwards, or like for the rest of the day, especially like when you're still adapting to like longer bouts. It's easy to feel like absolute garbage for the rest of the day afterwards, and like get these headaches and feel exhausted and like you need a nap all day. And if you feel ruined for the rest of the day after you run, it's almost always a sign that you need to be eating more specifically somewhere around that bout of exercise. And that's something I recommend everybody who's in that position experiment with, because sometimes it's miraculous. Like, I had to initially plan my long runs on days that I didn't have to use my brain or work afterwards because I was so dead. And by simply, and I knew I needed carbs. I was eating a decent amount as it stood, but turns out I needed even more, and that completely solved the problem for me.
What sorts of races have you done in the past, and what were some of your kind of fueling strategies at the time?
So I've gone, I guess the longest race that I've done was a 15-mile trail race, and then I trained for a marathon and got injured like right as I was peaking for it, so I couldn't actually run it. So I've run up to 20 miles at this point, but The fueling strategies, the problem is sometimes they go out the window when you're actually in the race context. So I always bring a tremendous amount with me, but especially in Arizona, it's hot. You don't want to be taking anything in, especially once your gels and everything are also hot. It's kind of disgusting. And so usually I end up finishing a race not consuming as much as I should have, regretting it, having to eat a tremendous amount afterwards, and then still not feeling awesome. But I have found that for me personally, leveraging liquid carbs is like the name of the game, personally. And also, in case this is relevant to any of your listeners, since I'm in Arizona, I will typically have like a flask ready to go and then a flask that I've frozen. So one is like good for now, and then one will sort of melt as my
Interesting.
session goes on.
Super
And
smart.
just the temperature makes such a difference for me in terms of my willingness to consume this when I'm already dying. So little hacks like that can honestly make a big difference too.
That's really smart. I mean, in the ultra space right now, ice bandanas are huge, you know, and just like just staying cool. I'm such a baby with the heat. I did a half marathon, and we have a heat wave in the Northeast for the last like 5 days. It was like 30, 30, 30, 30, 70, 70, 70, 70, 70. And the first day that it was 70 degrees was that day in my half marathon. And I didn't know that. I was like, oh, it's gonna be a little bit warmer the next day. It was like 72, sunny, beating down on me. And I was like, I'm A, physiologically not prepared for any heat at all. But even like some people are like, oh, 70, it's a nice day. Like, to me, I'm like dying of sweat. I have a super high sweat rate, lose a ton of sodium. Didn't I brought enough water? Like you said, fueling strategies can change in the winter. I brought a fueling strategy that where I wouldn't be pouring sweat the whole time, completely ill prepared. Like 30 minutes in, I was like, you got to adjust some stuff or you're going to die here, you know? So, Arizona's crazy.
It's very easy to underestimate just how impactful the heat is, but it's depressing sometimes when you go out on those like first couple summer runs and you're just gassed at paces that should not be as taxing as they are. So I think people also just need to like be conscious of that and show themselves a little bit of grace when that's the case.
We're gonna wrap up, but I think my final thing, and then I'm gonna throw it to you, would just be if you're someone out there who's never fueled your training, and that can be something before, that can be something during, that can be prioritizing carbohydrates afterwards. If you've never cared about it, I think habitual intake and habitual diet and lifestyle is gonna matter by far the most for almost every outcome. But if you've never tried and you are worried about distributing some calories in that direction, like, give it a chance. You might find, wow, those workouts that wrecked me, they don't wreck me. And because they haven't wrecked me, my energy's better throughout the day and I'm not as ravaged. And these are positive, net positive trade-offs. I don't know that it's going to be that rosy ride off in the sunset outcome, but it might be. And it's worth just trying, or at least considering. That's what I hope somebody can take home from this. Anything you feel we missed, anything you want to leave the listener from a fueling perspective, from a in-depth to create buy-in perspective, or anything else you came here and you wanted to say today?
I think just to kind of like put a bow on what you just said, I think yes, it always makes sense to kind of focus on the bigger rocks first and what your habitual diet looks like first. And I usually don't even get into like the intricate discussions of pre, intra, and post-workout fueling with clients initially because I care most about calibrating their overarching intake first. But then once you've kind of gotten into a decent rhythm there, that's 100% the next thing that's worth exploring because to your point, if any part of you ever struck, especially if any part of you ever struggles with like recovery or crazy soreness or like kind of struggling to stay on top of training at a high quality because of variables such as that, sometimes fueling is the solution. And even if you don't, again, it's almost never going to hurt. You will typically perform better. And therefore, even if you don't care about like your one rep max back squat, you're training for a reason, and that reason has something to do with the training adaptations, and you're going to get better training adaptations if you are able to produce higher quality sessions on a regular basis. So that is why it's worth it to you, even if you don't necessarily care ob about objective performance metrics like some of us might.
Awesome. Totally agree with that. Where can people find you and follow you and interact with you?
People can just find me on Instagram. That's pretty much the only place I exist. Dr. Emily Dow is my handle, all just one word, and it's DOW. Very easy. I really have nothing else to promote. I am just out there putting
What are
content
you
out these
doing
days.
like career wise, what do you what do you do for money? You know, like what do you do in terms of working with people?
Yeah, so well, up until recently, I've been coaching throughout this entire process too. I'm a dietitian, so I have the ability to kind of practice in a different context. But I've largely retired from coaching. I have like a very small handful of people that I'm continuing to work with. However, my main day job is I'm a professor now at the University of Arizona, so I get to teach within the Nutrition and Human Performance program. And that has taken up a tremendous amount of my time, but it's been a blast to interact with those students.
Super cool. It's awesome. It's really cool. Well, if you listen to this podcast, you made it this far, you should absolutely go follow Emily. I'm sure you realize that by now. You don't need to meet it. If you made it this far on the podcast, you know that that's a good idea. So to sum up, thank you for coming on. You're wonderful. You do great on social media. One of my favorite follows. So keep doing what you do.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being invited on.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.